Hello. I would like to call to order today's Planning Commission, Shoreline Planning Commission meeting on Thursday, July 17th, 2025. Carla, first I'll learn how to talk. Carla, could you call roll, please?
Chair Brinson?
I am here.
Commissioner Lynn?
Here.
Vice Chair Mosier?
Here as well.
Thank you. Commissioner Povich?
Here.
And we have Commissioner Cabe, Commissioner Fry, and Commissioner Hadley are absent with notice. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Next is approval of the agenda. Excellent, it is approved. Approval of the meeting minutes from July 3rd, 2025. Also approved. And now, Carla, do we have general public comment?
I have no general public comment for this evening. A couple for the public testimony, though. Thank you.
Okay. With that, we will move on to the public hearing. Tonight's public hearing is on the development code amendments to eliminate parking minimums. The purpose for this hearing is to obtain public testimony and for the commission to develop a recommendation to forward to the city council on this topic. Hold, please. Okay. Public comments are limited to 3 minutes per person testifying. When the clerk calls your name for either in-person or remote comment, please state your name and city of residence for the record before you begin. The process for this public hearing is as follows. The city will present its staff report, and then the commission will be given the opportunity to ask clarifying questions, and then individuals will be given opportunity to testify, and after all the testimony has been received, the commission will begin deliberation and may ask questions of the staff or individuals who testified. And then the commission will vote and close the public hearing. I now wish to open the public hearing. Take it away.
Thank
Steve.
You. Steve Saffron, Senior Planner, Planning and Community Development Department, and I'm here to present the vehicle and bicycle parking development code amendments. Quick summary, as part of the update of the comprehensive plan, the City Council did adopt policy LU 3.2, which says within the first 6 months of this year, update development code regulations to eliminate minimum parking ratios. And we have been doing this since cities around the country have been eliminating minimum parking requirements, eliminating city imposed parking requirements. Can have many benefits such as right-sized parking for commercial and residential properties, the potential for more affordable housing, reduced hardscape, and better safety for vehicles and pedestrians and bicyclists. Early in the process, staff did go to the council to get initial guidance about what these code amendments should be. So they did direct staff to consider removing parking minimums citywide and not just specific areas of the city. They said to look at reducing parking minimums for all uses, not just certain uses. Consider electric vehicle parking the same as all other parking requirements, and update bicycle standards to better fit the needs of all users. So the proposed development amendments in your attachment would generally eliminate vehicle parking minimums for all uses citywide, keeps design requirements if parking is provided, such as location screening and parking lot landscaping. It does keep requirements if you are providing parking for drive aisles and parking stall dimensions. It increases bike parking requirements for new development, which includes short and long-term requirements for middle housing, multifamily, schools, and commercial uses, and such. Adds new bike parking design requirements related to location, mounting racks, and spacing requirements. Allows administrative departures to vehicle and bike parking standards. So this gives staff the flexibility to amend some of those rules administratively. And it just generally cleans up cross-references and code citations. I'm not going to go through 90 pages of code for you, but some highlights, which you will see in your attachment A, is eliminating parking-related decision criteria in all types of permits, conditional use permits, special use permits, master development plan permits. It also updates the purpose statement to emphasize limiting the number of parking spaces, encourages the use of alternative modes of transportation, provide for better pedestrian movement, protection of air and water quality, and establishes the flexible standards. Generally gets rid of all of the minimum parking tables in 2050-390 and the whole of 2050-400, which is the parking reduction section. We're going to have some nice new drawings instead of the ones we've had since 1998, as far as I know. So much better drawings, much better bicycle parking figures that show types of bicycle facilities, spacing, and location requirements. And with that, staff is recommending that the Planning Commission do recommend approval of the proposed development code amendments as shown in your attachment A.
My button doesn't work. Great, thank you, Steve. Okay, do commissioners have any clarifying questions? All right, moving on. We are ready for public testimony.
Okay, I have Gabriel Sneed, and Gabriel, if you would state your name and the city of residence, and you have 3 minutes, and you are now unmuted.
Okay, it says I'm unmuted, so I hope you can hear me. I'm Gabriel Sneed, and I live in Shoreline in Meridian Park. I wanted to say Shoreline is growing quickly and has a stated desire to increase housing and livability while decreasing carbon footprint. Eliminating parking minimums allows for more development and encourages non-car-centric development and transport. We should eliminate these as soon as we can because we don't risk decreasing parking supply. No one is losing any parking. By eliminating mandatory minimums, we just allow developers and business owners to determine their parking needs independently. Eliminating parking minimums is in line with the city's comprehensive plan, the climate action plan, and economic development plans. So I encourage you to eliminate these mandatory minimums entirely. Thank you.
And next we have Katie Laura, I believe it's pronounced. And if you would do the same, state your name and city of residence, you are unmuted.
Hi, good evening. My name is Katie Laura. I live in Ridgecrest. And a big part of why my family and I moved to Shoreline was access to transit and that it seemed like the city was planning for its own growth in really smart and progressive ways. I think that taking the step in eliminating parking minimums is a great example of how we're putting that into practice. And so I want to express my wholehearted support. A lot of my neighbors and I agree that we're excited for Shoreline to become more affordable, more walkable, better connected, greener, and more equitable. And I think this policy is a no-brainer to help us get there. So I hope we can move quickly and move smart. Decoupling the bike parking requirements from vehicle parking requirements, as the staff report calls for, is a great addition. More flexibility to add different kinds of bike parking will be super important as we move more trips out of cars. I'll just mention, too, that my professional background is in urban planning, and I only mention that because parking minimums are pretty much universally seen by the planning community as a vestige of an earlier age. It's the age of highway expansion, the hollowing out of walkable downtown centers in favor of the car-centric suburbs. These are all policies that are now being revisited as harmful mistakes because they've contributed to a lot of crises. Our cities are less affordable, they're more inequitable, more socially isolating, and more harmful to our climate. So when mandates are rolled back, landowners get to decide, parking still gets built, it just doesn't get overbuilt. It's just way more appropriate for the kinds of urban infill and middle housing projects we want to attract. Thank you.
Sorry about that. I have, that is all for this public hearing. And as well, I did forward several written public testimony to the commission. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Yes, we received, I want to say at least, at my last count, 6 or 7, all expressing support with one bit of concern about the transition from now until the future. With that,
I move to recommend approval of the vehicle and bicycle parking related to development code amendments in attachment A of the staff report to the city council.
I would second that.
Excellent. Now, discussion.
I mean, I think as everyone pointed out, I think it makes sense. I mean, one, it helps us take away a fairly arbitrary set of standards that differ from city to city and neighborhood to neighborhood and don't necessarily improve our cityscape any, but it also says, it helps, as we talked about at a different meeting recently, you know, our competing desires, it helps us reallocate land usage to things that we say we want, like more trees, less hardscape, more housing, more sidewalks, and we can better use funds that are spent on parking for all those things.
You stole my stop talking points.
Say it again.
Rachel?
I want to add, this may allow more building more units to support increase of critical area buffer that's coming in place. Thanks.
Yeah, definitely. Julie? I think the other thing that I just wanted to comment on, I know that staff did a ton of work on the bicycle parking, that a lot of it felt like it was new and we were kind of inventing, or that we were moving with new language. And I like the idea, the flexibility that we put in about allowing parking in units, because I think in the same way of removing parking from our lots with development, removing the sort of requirement for big overbuilt bicycle storage into units that maybe is more useful, can help maybe get one or more, two more units into those developments. So appreciate the work that was done there. All right, now what I do. And now, oh, Chris.
Nope, sorry.
And now I do something. I ask Carla to call a vote.
That's right. If you're okay. Finished with comments. Okay. Commissioner Povic.
Yes, I agree.
Okay. Vice Chair Mosier.
Yes.
And Commissioner Lynn.
Yes.
And Chair Brinson.
Yes.
Thank you.
We'll get this. First time for everything, y'all. And with that vote, I hear 4 in favor, and we move the recommendation forward to City Council, and I close this public hearing. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Next up, Elise, our study item, our discussion of the Environmentally Critical Areas Code.
What is happening? I was trying to, that's not right.
Should we do that?
Hold on.
Oh, that's a good question.
Oh,
that looks right.
Sweet.
Okay. So do you want to see the presentation?
Chair Brinson, would it be okay to have a public comment regarding this item that
Absolutely.
Came after the public comment?
Yeah. Would you like to do it now?
Yes.
Yes. Please, let's do that.
Okay, Janet Way, if you would state your name and city of residence, and thank you.
Good evening, commissioners. I'm Janet Way, resident of Shoreline, and I am representing Shoreline Preservation Society. And I've been working on these critical areas for many, many years. I was on the city council and before that, whoops. So it's something that I've had quite a bit of interaction with. And one of the things I wanna speak about is that You know, I think that the write-up is pretty good. It has a lot of encouraging things in it. However, I'm concerned about the map that's on the agenda, and I mean it's a very colorful map, and it has a lot of detail, but I'm concerned that a lot of the creeks are shown as not in effect not very important, because they're either in a pipe or they don't have anadromous fish stock. However, many of them do have salmonids. They have cutthroat trout, which are salmonids, and so many of them do have fish, or they have habitat which could be fish habitat if only the fish could get there. So, and the example I like to use is the Snoqualmie River. So above the falls, no fish can get up there. However, it's still a river, correct? And so same thing goes for our creeks. You know, even if the fish can't get there, the creek is still a creek, and it still matters. Also, the buffers for those creeks still matter, because we're talking about clean water, we're talking about habitat for lots of other creatures. So they should be, you know, given the utmost respect. So critical areas means critical. And so I'd like you to consider that. Also, other critical areas, such as steep slopes and wetlands, aren't mentioned as much. But the steep slopes are extremely important to our creeks. And they are the places where we have often a lot of trees that need to be protected, because that protects the stream. And then there's steep slopes, you know, nearby. So for instance, Paramount Park has some steep slopes surrounding it, and there's a lot of wetlands in the park. And so some of the most valuable wetlands are the ones that sometimes have sort of slopes around it, and those areas really are protected by the trees that are on the slopes. But in the case of Paramount Park, a lot of those slopes are private property. And so, you know, they could be given protection by being other means. And so it's something to consider. There's a lot of things that I'd like to continue on. I don't know how much time I have left here.
One minute.
Okay, so I would just like to ask that you consider on this map how to improve the importance of these creeks. So even if they're in a pipe, they could be habitat, and they are habitat. For instance, Thornton Creek that runs under I-5 is now being, the culvert is now being replaced, because the tribes and the WSDOT demanded that culvert be replaced so the fish can get up there. And I personally, about 20 years ago, saw a steelhead that made it under I-5 and through Twin Ponds and up into adjoining property. The steelhead, that was my fish that I found, and we had lots of witnesses. So fish want to get there. You just need to give them the opportunity. So I'd like to ask that, you know, we give maximum protection to these critical areas, especially when it comes to development. And Firrcrest is an example right now where the trees are being lost, and it's got Hamlin Creek, which needs to be given some consideration. So those are just a few things, but I appreciate you listening and considering all these things very carefully, critically. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want that fish to have a name. Elise.
Good evening. Good evening, Commissioners. Elise Keim, Planning Manager here at the City of Shoreline, to discuss our Critical Areas Code update. So I am going to be going over, hang on, Zoom's doing strange things and blocking my view. Okay. I am going to be going over some information about the critical areas in the context of the comprehensive plan. Our current critical areas regulations, riparian ecosystems, we'll take a look at some of those maps to understand the area of effect, and taking a look at how streams impact and are impacted by the city's plans. So just to take us back to where we were about 2 weeks ago, we were introduced to WDFW's guidance for streams. This is a best available science. Just speak closer. Okay. This is the best available science published document by the agency that really focused on riparian ecosystems. That's that upland area around an active stream channel. And WDFW's guidance was using something called site potential tree height in order to determine the width of those riparian ecosystems. To help local jurisdictions figure out what that was, WDFW has published a tool, a site potential tree height tool. And in jurisdictions like Shoreline, it is using an estimate of what a potentially 200-year-old tree, how tall it might get in Shoreline based on the types of soils. And so an estimated 202-foot riparian ecosystem is what WDFW recommends for Shoreline. What we understand from this is this impacts about 536 new parcels that previously were not impacted by streams or their buffers. And at our last meeting, staff were looking for guidance from Planning Commission on whether to spend time and effort looking at alternative methods to identify riparian ecosystem width or to go with what WDFW has here with this estimated 202-foot width. So at our last meeting, Planning Commission requested some additional information before giving guidance, and that was at the comprehensive plan context for critical areas regulations and city growth. Understanding really what it means to be a property impacted by critical areas regulations. So if this area of effect is increasing, what does that mean on the ground, basically? And then taking a look at what the city's plans for the future around daylighting streams or property acquisition and how these riparian ecosystems might influence them. So first up, critical areas and the comprehensive plan. The comprehensive plan was adopted at the end of last year, and it includes 10 elements, all which work to help achieve Shoreline's vision for its future. And staff took a look through the plan to try to pull some goals and policies that seemed most relevant to the topic of the critical areas ordinance update. And we found a number of items related to protecting and preserving environmentally critical areas, making sure development regulations minimize impacts, and using best available science when we're crafting regulations to protect, enhance, and restore native wildlife habitats, specifically the structure and function of streams. And to, as we grow as a city and we plan for and accommodate that growth, making sure that we're mitigating both environmental and displacement impacts. This could be things around preserving trees and promoting low impact development. And Commission had asked, like, is the comprehensive plan sort of tilting one way or another? And I think much like the Growth Management Act, all of the elements of the comprehensive plan really worked together in order to help achieve the city's vision, and that sort of balancing act comes more to our decision makers rather than necessarily, it's not necessarily weighted in the plan in one direction or another. So next we're going to talk about our current critical areas regulations. So the present code says that critical areas and their associated buffers are to be maintained in their existing state in order to preserve their current functions and values. And I just wanted to point out that an existing state can mean a lot of different things. you can have something very heavily impacted and have really degraded ecosystem functions and values, or you can have incredibly pristine ecosystems and everything in the middle. So that's sort of a guiding framework of the critical areas regulations, is that it makes sure existing functions and values are maintained even if degraded, and the point is that they not drop any further. So with that, the Critical Areas Code has a number of allowed uses and activities, as it recognizes several properties are already developed in ways that perhaps under current regulations would not be allowed today. And these allowed uses and activities, they vary by critical area. So the ones in the staff report are really specific to streams and their buffers. So these allowed activities kind of fall into three buckets. It's about maintenance, repair, and replacement of existing features, responding if there is an emergency in a critical area, and allowing for modifications and alterations to existing improvements. And those are kind of the main categories. And essentially, if you're not on the list, you're not an allowed activity, is how the Critical Areas Code really works. So when you're thinking of doing new impacts or expanding an impacted area, typically, those are not allowed except in very limited circumstances. And importantly, even if you're engaging in an allowed activity, that does not entitle you to degrade a critical area or increase the risk associated with a critical area. So you need to be able to, whatever activity that you're doing, that it's following best management practices, observing safety protocols, those types of things. And these allowed uses and activities, they apply to everyone. So if it's a utility purveyor, if it's the parks department, if it's a private property, if it's a business, all of them are subject to the Critical Areas Code. So to bring that sort of into more focus, we've got some examples of some allowed activities on a fairly simple site plan. So this site plan has a stream and associated buffer, and what are you allowed to do on this property? So if you have an established lawn, you can maintain that established lawn. By all means, go ahead and mow the lawn. If you want to do an interior home remodel, or in this instance, you want to pop a second story on that existing building, that is absolutely allowed. If, let's say, the critical area is overgrown with blackberries, as so many of ours really are, you can do some limited clearing. You can't go too wild because it can kind of mess up the soil, but you can do some limited clearing of invasive species. And importantly, if a tree in a critical area does become hazardous, then it can be removed in conjunction with an evaluation from an arborist and notification to the city. Now let's look at some examples of what you can't do on this property. So let's say you were clearing out those blackberries in order to expand your lawn area. You cannot do that. You can maintain the existing lawn. You cannot have it encroach further into the critical area. If you're looking to expand your home, maybe it's a deck addition, maybe you want to do a cool pool on the back. If that's in a critical area, you're not doing that. You're gonna do that somewhere else on the property. If you're looking to plant invasive species for some reason, you really like blackberries, you're not doing that. And importantly, if there's a non-hazardous tree in a critical area, that is staying put, that's not coming down. Now, we do understand that essentially what the Critical Areas Code says is that if you have the option to build outside of the critical area or buffers, that's what you're going to do. You are not going to impact the critical area. However, how encumbered a property is by critical areas really can vary, as shown in the illustration here. So we do have a process where heavily impacted properties can pursue something called a reasonable use exception, because the Critical Areas Code is not meant to deprive a property of all reasonable use. That's not what it's about. So if someone, that's exists in our current code, that if someone does not have the option to not impact the critical area, they can pursue a reasonable use exception and impact the critical area. Importantly, then they do need to provide appropriate mitigation. At our last meeting, we talked about the area of effect of riparian ecosystems, and there was a request to look at some maps. So just in summary from last time, the riparian ecosystems looks at a 202-foot riparian ecosystem area, which is a change from the previous code, which looked at buffers that were of variable widths. So we do see that the riparian ecosystem area of effect is getting larger, and it impacts about 500 more properties. One of the questions Commission asked was about, we just did all of this rezoning. What is the deal with riparian ecosystems and our new zoning designations? And as staff was working through the rezoning, they very intentionally tried to keep areas with open channel streams to have the lowest zoning designation. So that was neighborhood residential 3 under our new zoning code. But as you can see, there are various properties of various different types of zoning designations that do have critical areas impacts of riparian management zones. Many of these already had stream buffer impacts. It's just the size of that impact has changed. Another question that Commission had was about, hey, very often streams are not the only critical area occurring, and there may be others. So what's the difference in terms of properties that are already impacted by some critical area versus those that are just going to be newly impacted? So we took a look and did an analysis of our other critical areas, streams, wetlands, slope hazards, flood hazards, and the shoreline designation. And there's about 4,300 properties in shoreline that have some sort of critical areas designation on them. And what we found in running the analysis is that we end up with about 450 new properties that previously had no critical areas designation, but now they would. They would have a riparian ecosystem. And so that's what this looks like on this map here. You see the newly impacted parcels. They're outlined in the sort of orangish color. And you can see they occur all over the city. We've got some up in Ballinger. We've got some over in Innis Arden. They are all over the place, but they're obviously near a stream. And yes, ultimately, we ended up with about 450 newly impacted parcels. And important, that count, that can mean a corner of a lot, that can mean the majority of the lot. So I just want to point out that's sort of a limitation in the number, right? Is that I say it's 450, that level of impact varies basically lot to lot. Another question Commission had was about the city's plans for its future, and if we were looking at maybe daylighting streams, what that could mean for riparian ecosystems, or how the city acquires property typically for parks, and with all these riparian ecosystems getting larger, is that a thing that the city should consider as part of its property acquisition? So I spoke with both our surface water utility folks and our parks folks to try to get an understanding. And for the next 6 years, the surface water utility is really focused on maintenance and operations. They do have in the design phase some daylighting of Ballinger Creek, but that's not in the immediate horizon. And we are aware that Thornton Creek is through a WashDOT program looking at fish passage barrier removal and some daylighting of Thornton Creek. That project had been on hiatus for a while, but I think it is coming back, and based on the website, last I checked, it looked like they're looking in 2026. And we also spoke with parks to understand what they look at for property acquisition and do critical areas really inform that. And it is a component of a sort of a multi-factor analysis that the Parks Department does when looking to acquire property. So they absolutely look for, are there ecological benefits if we as a city become the steward of this property? But they also need to look at things like the community needs or desires for recreation and if there's any opportunities for unique amenities. So they look at sort of this holistic picture, and any updated critical areas maps would absolutely inform that type of decision making for them. Both, as I mentioned before, the critical areas code impacts everyone. So this includes our stormwater utility. This includes our parks department. As we're a growing city and we are trying to expand our parks, improve our parks, we want to make sure as writing this critical area code that it protects the functions and values of the critical area, but does make it possible for the city to meet its parks and recreation needs. So with that, we come back to the alternatives that staff is really hoping to get some guidance on. What staff see are basically two alternatives, is to essentially pursue WDFW's recommendation, utilize their site potential tree height based on the estimate that they provided of 202 feet for a riparian ecosystem size. We understand that this would increase the number of properties that are impacted by critical areas by about 450. We know that this would be protecting riparian areas and be consistent with WDFW's best available science, but we do know that there are data limitations. They did not have the soils data to know for sure what the conditions were for very tall and old growth trees in shoreline, so they provided this estimate. The alternative is for the city to essentially fund a separate best available science backed development for identifying riparian ecosystem size. I do want to make it clear that it's very likely going to still result in an increase in regulated area around streams. There may not be as many parcels impacted, but I do anticipate that there would be an increase. It will still absolutely protect riparian areas, and by doing the analysis that's more shoreline specific, there is the potential for greater accuracy. So those are kind of the two that we're seeing weighing, and just want to know which direction city staff should really focus their efforts and energy. That's that.
Awesome, thank you so much. I have a couple of clarifying questions, and maybe we'll start there and then move to discussion. I'm gonna go in backwards order. So on the daylit, the two streams that are planned to be eventually daylit, even if it's not immediately, are those already on the map? And would they automatically, once they are daylit, become this sort of bigger area?
So, does the cursor show up? It does. Okay.
It's a very small screen.
So.
Oh yeah, I see it.
Thornton Creek is running up here, mm-hmm. and it runs under I-5. And I don't believe they're daylighting under I-5, but they are going to, you know, change the infrastructure so it's easier for the fish. But it is already typed in our system as a type F stream. It's been a few months since I looked at their maps for their proposed daylighting area, but it's pretty close to what we're seeing here, which already shows the 200-foot riparian ecosystem. And then up in Ballinger, it's some areas that are piped, but I do see a number of sort of other critical areas. Mm-hmm. It's wet over there. So there's, yes, a potential for an increase there, but also some other critical areas are occurring.
Okay. But those are mostly already. I just wanted to make sure if we're talking about 456, it's not 456 plus a bunch mm-hmm. more. That was the first one. Second one was on the allowed uses, and I heard you say that it has to be stated to be allowed. In the staff report, it mentioned public utility work, but it didn't mention private utility work. And so I just wanted to, having just replaced some private service lines, mm-hmm. I just wanted to get clarification on that difference. Would that be a repair and maintenance activity, or would that be a...
So that's an area that we're really hoping, as we look at updating the code, to really think about private, think about public, and if that's a really important, meaningful distinction when we're talking about allowed uses, mm-hmm. because we run into these questions not infrequently with applicants and staff, and we administer the code as it's written, right? But we do know that there are limitations there. So through this update process, we'll be looking at those allowed activities to make sure sort of the who of what's allowed is really being contemplated, because we're also running into it sort of on the converse side of allowing private storm facilities but not public storm facilities, which is really challenging for our surface water utility. So I want to acknowledge that, making sure that's tidied up in the revised code.
Okay. Thank you. Other clarifying questions? Okay, I'll open it for discussion then. Chris.
Thank you for the clarification of private members of the public. That's good. I mean, I think I get that we have not complete data from Department of Fish and Wildlife, but also we spend a lot of time getting a lot of data to end up at somewhat similar answers. And I think when you look at the map with how many properties are already encumbered by ECAs, we're only talking about 400 new properties, some that may be further encumbered. It seems like that's okay to like be operating on limited data, because it's also a limited number of parcels, even in the context of the city, and that so many of them are encumbered. But I think if you think of them in a different way, like we talked about the other day with competing things, but if you look at like Fish and Wildlife already has a future state in mind with mm-hmm. this, which is a forest, and we already have stated goals to increase our tree canopy, this is like the perfect opportunity to do that in intentional places where we already don't want people to build. And so we may take away some development potential of parcels, but we also have the ability through our comprehensive plan docket to rezone properties nearby if we're diminishing some. So we still get we may take away a certain property owner's ability to do it, but we're not diminishing the city's ability to develop a property. So I'm for Fish and Wildlife, but I'm also for a kind of a standard, like a bigger standard that's not just a city by city standard way of looking at things.
I come from research, so I'm big on data. And I think that if I was a homeowner, I would want to have specific data as far as why somebody told me what I could do on my property that I had already purchased, instead of this vague, well, we think. I think we would owe it to our people, our constituents, that we have accurate data if we are asking them to do something that might affect them. Don't get me wrong, I played in creeks as a kid. I love them immensely. But I also think we need to think about how the homeowner would feel if we said, we don't want you to do this, but we really don't know why. Or we don't have really good information as to why we're telling you this.
So an important, what I think will be a feature of the code, really no matter what direction I receive tonight, is there will likely be a clause in there for basically site-specific determinations. So of basically what is the riparian ecosystem on that property. But that is a cost that then the property owner who's trying to do something bears. So that's something that we want to be aware of in making these types of policy choices. But that whatever direction is given, that absolutely would, to get the most accurate, is to really be site specific. But this sort of area of effect would say, okay, if you are proposing to do an addition, that, and you are in an area that's a riparian ecosystem, a mapped riparian ecosystem, you absolutely have the opportunity for a site-specific determination, and maybe that size changes, but also maybe it doesn't.
If we were to go the route of the alternate route, does that allow for the areas to be a bit more specific based on the ground, sort of, like, would there be site-specific considerations happening as part of the consulting work, like looking at existing conditions and clipping?
So potentially, I think that's what we need to figure out what the methodology is. We do know that it's a pretty common practice right now under sort of the buffer system. If the, let's say the stream's on one side of the road, and it's a 60-foot right-of-way, and your house is on the other, but you're getting caught up in the stream buffer, that there may not, in fact, be a hydrologic relationship between your property and the stream, and so the buffer is functionally clipped by the road, or if there are structures that are in the way, the ecosystem functions and values of high-quality native vegetation and stuff like that is interrupted, essentially. And so that, while it may be mapped, showing that, okay, your property is impacted, ultimately, if there's a road in the way, in fact, it might not be impacted. So that could change the number of impacted parcels. We're going based off of what's mapped. Doing further analysis, understanding, okay, then are some of those, are they truly impacted? Or is that just a function of the mapping? So
I think for me, it's, I'm struggling with the sort of fish and wildlife approach of ideal future state versus what we have now. And sort of, Julie, to your point, the idea of someone being impacted based on a future state that doesn't actually look at the existing conditions and how degraded they currently are, that's the piece that I struggle with in this, especially as we, you know, yes, there are only 456 lots, but how many potential housing units is that or could that be? And would there be, without much impact, right, in the sense of if it's already impervious surface, is adding a housing unit there any different? Wouldn't be allowed, but so that's the balancing act that I'm thinking about. And so I would like to see additional work. Go ahead.
For me, I sort of already on the side of wanting to support this already available assumption of 202. Reason being, I suspect the future study or our self or city sponsored, city funded BAS will come back with, say, 150 for some property, especially those that the fish may not be present. But the gain on those, I see it not significant enough. We can do a modeling or actual calculation doing the maximized possibility of unit development to compare the 202 versus, say, at 150 for those less significant stream and to get those, I mean, as a city, to compare the difference between the impact for overall city. And I am supporting the, usually individual development is, even like right now, before the regulation change, lots of homeowners or developers still would choose to go for their own study. Because it's the site that they are building on, and they may not agree with the kind of the blanket regulation, and from there they can apply for deviation or some other type of mitigation. What I see currently, there are some allowed, say, already built within the existing footprint. This is also my question. So within the existing footprint, if it is just renovation, like say they apply within the current building footprint to renovate their residence, is that allowed?
That is allowed, yes.
Right.
They could, in theory, within the existing building, add units. You know, you get a split-level house and you
right.
convert the lower level into an accessory dwelling unit.
So
that,
even
the house has not gotten bigger.
That's right. So even if the entire unit is within the future definition of within the ecological buffer zone, they can still remodel and rebuild into multiple units.
Yes.
So I so for that reason, I feel there is still a way to, because we know they are within a more sensitive area, and if their own study allow the development to happen and support, I think there's still a way. So, thanks.
Chris?
So I guess a question. So you talked about how part of the study may determine that if there's a road blocking it, then we could determine that it's functionally cut off by the road, which it most likely is because half of the piped ones are under roads. So we already kind of know. But is there a way, I'm just thinking of it, it's more, are we spending the cost to justify it, or is someone else spending the cost to justify building in a critical area? So is there a way we could do it through policy? Because my experience when I've done things in shoreline buffers is that you have to have a survey done anyway. So as part of having that survey done, you do have a map already. So could we just look at, I remember the fee for the reasonable use exception was quite expensive.
Yes.
Like, could we make it a little bit more reasonable, but not that, and also just have like a series of steps that could be taken at like a director's rule or administrative level where it's still okay without spending the time to go through a whole study? There's already a way out of it, but it's just not, we talked about this with like tree fees, it's like how much is too much for a tree fee? Like, is that too much to justify it when a survey and some basic information, at least in the context of like a road, could justify it?
I think my challenge is more around what is and isn't allowed and clarity on that piece than 202 feet versus 150 feet, I'm realizing. So I think it is more about, for me now, it's more about additional work on sort of what this means for those parcels. Sort of with the idea that if we're increasing it and, you know, a little bit of extra increase over time with, you know, these black lines, I think, which are the piped ones, you know, if those ideally someday get daylit, we haven't historically, you know, I think the staff report said that we haven't historically allowed, or we haven't historically seen a lot of exceptions. We might see more now, especially because these, you know, roughly 500 parcels are, you know, able to build a few units or a DADU or something. And so thinking about how we can lessen the burden on the property owner for proceeding through that process might be a good sort of middle ground. Like if someone were to come and say, it's a parking lot currently, can I build a DADU on it? That doesn't seem like that would be degrading the stream buffer versus the existing parking lot, which is just service runoff.
And that's something we absolutely can make sure is very clear in the exempt and allowed activities. Mm-hmm. Of course, recognizing that even if you're allowed, you don't get to degrade a critical area.
Right.
That is something that we can make, I think, a lot clearer.
Okay. I've shifted.
I will say that, so this might be, you know, getting a little bit too black and white, but I think that, you know, as I said, I'm big on data, and I think that it's a slippery slope to kind of say, well, you know, we could have the accurate data, but we choose not to, and we're going to affect your property. I think that I couldn't stand there and say that to somebody. And if I couldn't say that to somebody, then I wouldn't want somebody to either be in the city and say that to somebody or be on the receiving end of it. If somebody was going to tell me that something that was going to affect me deeply, I would want them to have the stats to back it up. And it, you know, I think that to me, that is the deciding factor. It's not whether or not there's a road, it's not whether or not whatever. It's the fact that making those kinds of decisions and not having accurate data is a very slippery slope for us to go down. And I think we should just not do that. So I spent my life in healthcare and lives were at risk. So that's where I come from.
I guess I would take the other approach, where if you looked at this map, nothing that is on this map would have ever been allowed to be built in that way. And I don't think we've ever, around here, like especially if you look at the west side of the city, and it started in Bowen Creek Park, there's a lovely little old platting map that shows it all as timber holdings. So like we've never really taken this land seriously outside of its development potential. And this is kind of our time to start correcting some of that. And it may impact some people, but as a city as a whole, it's better for the city as a whole, I think. And so that's that balance. I mean, we did the same thing with the comp plan. We have some data, but some of it was maps that show a distance from a bus stop, but because it's a squiggly line, it might hit part of a lot. And so that's already like an incomplete kind of data in some way. So we already, some way, look at something that's not perfect to justify an outcome. And I do think within this one, as Les said, if there's a clear yes and no, what you can do, and I think if there's a way that's achievable and accessible to develop something. But also I think when you were talking about some of our developments, 4, 6, 8 units, which might not be your average homeowner doing it anyway. Also, I noticed that some of the west side of the city is HOA, which is not gonna be as developed as the center parts of the city.
I will just, the science and its limitations, the expectation is best available science, and that can be incomplete. That's, I think, an acknowledged limitation, right? Our previous, 10 years ago, the recommendation was to vary the buffers based on whether or not fish were present, and WDFW has done a lot of research and said, you know what, no, that's not the way to do it, and this is our recommendation now. So that has changed, but yes, we do have limitations on the model that they prepared specifically relevant to soils. So potentially we could find some other data set with soils. I can't say whether or not it will change the site potential tree height. I just don't know. But that's we use the science that is best available, but acknowledge that can be incomplete. And we do have a requirement on properties that do have critical areas that they do a delineation and classification of the critical area site specific. So our maps are always a starting point. And then let's say you're planning to do a development that's not like an outright allowed use. You're doing more than mowing the lawn. We're going to require a critical areas report prepared by a qualified professional that says, okay, these are the critical areas on your property. You have this type of stream, and these are the type of buffers per the code. There are also steep slopes, and this is the category of steep slopes. And so the report has to talk about all of those things, very site specific, and then it's also specific what you're doing, right? Are you putting in a mini split that has like a very small footprint? Or are you doing a 5,000 square foot home renovation or new home builds? Like that's different, and it absolutely gets site specific when we're talking about impacts to critical areas. So that expectation is going to stay no matter what. We need to have absolutely the best data that we can that is site specific if someone's going to be doing work on a property with critical areas. Our code currently says that. That's the plan for it to continue to say that, so that we can maintain those existing functions and values, which is our obligation.
I'm gonna pick on your example a tiny bit.
Sure.
So in the instance of that homeowner putting in a mini split, they're doing a critical area report?
So that, we would say, that's a minor activity, right? Unless it's directly next to the salmon spawning stream,
right.
We'd say, no, you can't, but if it's, right, that would be something where we say, that's minor, you don't need a report, that's gonna be okay. But if you're doing a huge house or anything that's going to impact a critical area, we're going to need a specific report about it.
I think to Julie's point, for me, it's less about the 202. I think that, we have the data from WDFW, that it isn't specific, but it's their best available science. So I think that piece is okay. But I think this sort of like making the code rational for people so that, I mean, I have heard and seen so many examples where there's like a 1 foot difference in that, tanks a thing or it doesn't, making sure that we're really thinking about this impact, like this impact, because this is a new restriction. This is, I mean, I don't know the impact to property values based on this change, but it seems real. And so that's the concern that I have, is that people who are living and own these properties, that they aren't facing sort of additional, I think for the exemption, you know, an extreme cost to get an exemption for something that makes sense and isn't, with the full understanding that what I'm talking about is not intentionally harming the critical area. It's just making sure that people can do what they can do on their property, and it's maintaining the current state. That's the, I want to be really clear that I'm not trying to build a high rise next to the salmon spawning area.
Mm-hmm. 200 feet away.
Please. 200 feet away. Do you have what you need from us?
I think so. I know there's an even number, but by my count, I heard three that said, go with the 202, one that said, would like to have more information. But I also heard whatever that we're doing, that the property owners not face extreme cost burdens or procedural burdens, and that the code makes sense and that it is protecting the critical areas. So having those be sort of the guiding lights.
One extra clarifying question. The critical area code covers other types of critical areas.
Yes.
Are we having other conversations about additional ads, or is it only this riparian zone one? And are there other changes that we're looking at there?
Generally? Sure. So when we did our best available science analysis of the current code, the area where we found, oh, we need to update, is related to riparian ecosystems, because there was a new publication from WDFW that said, this is the way to do it now. It's not whether or not fish are present. all the streams are important. So that's where we saw we need to change. And so our intention was not to go changing things with the other codes, but recognizing we've had this code for about a decade, and staff have a lot of experience with it, as well as applicants, and there are some opportunities for clarification and improvement, and perhaps ease of organization of the code. That was another place where we were going to spend our efforts. So you'll probably see language related to geohazards as an example, but it's more about clarifying expectations rather than changing them. So
okay, that's helpful. Thank you. All right. If you have what you need from us, I think so. We are good. Until the next time.
Yes, which will, I think, be next month.
All right, moving on to unfinished business. Nope, how about new business? Someday I'm gonna combine all these together. Reports and announcements. The agenda for our next meeting.
Thank you.
Which is August 7th.
On August 7th, let's see, we have the...
Is this right?
Just making sure. It wasn't on here the last time I looked at it.
Oh.
No? Okay.
We have some things.
Yeah. We know for sure we have co-living housing. This is a new requirement per the state, and so we're going to be making some exciting changes to our code, and that is... going to be sort of a preview of the batch. I think I understand what's happening here. Yes. Okay. The topic is going to be co-living housing.
Okay.
What's, I mean,
that's a good question, Julie.
On August 7th, you'll learn.
Where are you going to be on August 7th,
exactly.
2025?
Would you like me to answer? Yeah. These are essentially, have you heard of things like apartments or micro units? It's those.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. We'll get into all of the nuance for what that means.
Yeah. Okay. And with that, I think we are adjourned. Thank you.